taken a dozen years and some 22 films, but Marvel Comics is finally brought to an end, supposedly, its Infinity Saga series. And that final chapter, Avengers Endgame, is breaking box office records all over the world. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss Avengers Endgame, along with two other films, Under the Silver Lake and Diane. So don't touch that dial, because another edition of Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
The Monterey Pop Festival of 1967 launched the careers of Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Otis Redding, and other iconic musicians and bands.
Experience this groundbreaking event in a showing of the restored D.A. Pennebaker Festival documentary at the Spokane Public Radio Thank You event, Wednesday, June 12th at 7 o'clock at the Bing Crosby Theater.
The evening starts with Dan Webster, Mary Pat Truthart, and Nathan Weinbender discussing Monterey Pop and other music documentaries.
60s memorabilia courtesy of 4,000 Holes.
This event celebrates Spokane Public Radio volunteers, business supporters, and grantors.
Thanks also to Strong Solutions, the Cleaning Authority, and Vinoa Wine Shop for helping to make this possible.
Monterey Pop, June 12th, 7 p.m. at the Bing.
Tickets are available at all Tickets West outlets or online at ticketswest.com.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that has never threatened to break box office records, even in our own homes. That said, such records are only one sign, and not always a good one, of overall quality. The latest film in the Marvel Comics cosmos, Avengers Endgame, earned an astounding $1.2 billion internationally in its first 5 days of release. Good news for Marvel Comics, which, despite the film's title, can be depended upon to find some way to keep the good times going. The three of us will critique the film while doing our best not to give away any spoilers, along with two films that have far less of a public profile. Under the Silver Lake, which had only a bare minimum theatrical release before moving to video on demand, and Diane, which played briefly in Spokane, but also can be seen VOD. Let's begin with our favorite gaggle of superheroes, which, as anyone who is not a zygote knows, goes under the collective designation Avengers. Following 2018's Avengers Infinity War, which saw our rugged band fail in their attempt to stop the galactic demagogue Thanos, played by a CGI-disguised Josh Brolin, from eliminating half the Earth's population, Endgame picks up with the survivors, some of them at least, attempting to pick up the pieces and forge on. Others, such as Thor, Chris Hemsworth, and Hawkeye, Jeremy Renner, have taken alternate routes, either by diving into a bottle or becoming a murderous agent of revenge. The core, however, mainly Captain America, Chris Evans, Black Widow, Scarlett Johansson, and War Machine, Don Cheadle, attempts to get the two brains, the Hulk, Mark Ruffalo, and Iron Man, Robert Downey Jr., to help them find a way to, well, it's useless trying to cover up the fact that time travel is involved. Whatever. It all builds over a 3-hour running time to a huge climax that, if it doesn't actually bring the series to an end, at least ends this particular timeline. And if nothing else, it gives the most ardent of audience members a chance to hit the restrooms before their bladders burst.
As you know, I'm probably not the ideal candidate to kick off our discussion of Avengers Endgame, because I can't even get straight which are DC comics and which are Marvel comics and so forth. So
here, I have a handy chart for you that
okay,
I carry
good.
Around in my
wallet. Because I have these people yeah. all sort
for
of...
just these occasions.
Good.
Chart? That's an entire notebook. What
well,
are you talking
it
about?
It unfolds, you know.
Yes.
Right. But I'm just going to kick things off by saying, despite the fact that this movie's running time, as Dan indicated, is over 3 hours, I was with it the whole way, because we do, without again revealing too much, we do see all of our favorite characters inextricably intertwined in various plot points and courses of dealing with one another and so forth and so on. I also really liked the fact that they took some of the themes of the original stories involving Thor, for example, and flipped it upside down, because this Thor, Chris Hemsworth, one of the most beautiful men on the planet, does not resemble our earlier incarnations of what we think of as Thor. And
he's
so
hilarious.
I liked that. I also liked the fact that, I mean, we are seeing, as Dan indicated, I don't think you can move away from the fact that time travel is involved, but we see various things that occasionally get a little confused in terms of the timeline and present, future, past, days of future past, thanks to the Moody Blues. But at the same time, I managed to stay with it. I thought the costumes, the performances, I mean, we're dealing with A-list actors, and we know they can do things that are better, different, more, or whatever. But I thought it was a good time, and I don't think people will be disappointed. I know some people who have already seen it 3 times.
Wow.
And it's only been out for, what?
Nine hours?
Yeah, seriously.
Just, well, you know, not everyone has a life.
I got certainly not me. I've only seen Avengers Endgame once, but I enjoyed it as well. I mean, this is the culmination of, if my numbers are correct, 22 movies over the course of 11 years. That's a feat unto itself. And I mean, this movie does almost play out like a tribute to itself, because there is this time travel dimension. And I was reminded, and in fact, it's clocked in the dialogue, I was reminded of Back to the Future 2, where you've got characters going back and messing with events of the original movie. And they play around with this too. In fact, there's
a running joke,
a string of references to time travel movies.
And Back to the Future specifically.
Yeah. And I liked actually the first hour of this movie the best of the three hours, because it was disarmingly somber and dark.
That was a kicker of a beginning.
That
opening sequence
it's the best Hawkeye's been. Amazing.
It's
really good, and I almost wish it had been that dark for longer, because the Russo brothers, who wrote and directed this and several other Marvel movies, come from comedy. They come from TV sitcoms, and so these movies have at times kind of been a little too jokey for me. I mean, we complain that the DC movies are too somber, and then I come in here saying, now Marvel's too jokey. But they kind of undercut the material a little bit with one-liners, as if they're afraid that if they're dark for too long, they'll lose the audience. And I think that at this point, Marvel can do pretty much anything. They could do a My Dinner with Andre between, you know, Thor and Captain America, and it would make $1 jillion. Mm-hmm. And I think the tone, for the most part, is more on the jokey side, even if it is dealing with kind of the fallout of Thanos snapping his fingers and killing off 50% of the universe's population, which does include animals, we do discover here. So for a movie that is basically factory engineered to be fan service, I thought that this was fun. I've never been as in love with the Marvel universe as others. Even though I've mostly enjoyed the movies, I kind of look at them as products as opposed to great pieces of cinematic art. But this is really fun, and I think that it does pay off in ways that are dramatically satisfying and, I suppose, emotionally satisfying. I mean, there are some major things that happen at the end. We're not going to get into spoilers that I thought were effective. The friend I saw it with actually cried during it. I did not. But
there were some
criers in the screening that I was in. So yeah. I think this is basically calibrated to do what it does.
Yeah.
And it does it effectively.
I've never been a huge Avengers fan, because I thought, as opposed to your comment about it being too jokey, I've thought that they were too somber. I mean, come on, we're talking about superheroes. Chris Nolan's The Dark Knight, if that movie is the apex of these kinds of movies, mm-hmm. then I think that everything has to be a little bit lighter. And I thought the early Avengers films was way, way too dark. To tell you the truth, over the time getting them all mixed up, when you have a movie that comes out 3 years later, how are you supposed to keep together everything?
Well, I think they expect you to have done your homework.
Probably. Or to buy a DVD,
yeah.
Go back and look.
Yeah.
I think the only thing that people need to really do is to have watched the last one, the Civil War one, because that's the one that
Infinity
leads
War.
Infinity War, which leads into this exactly.
Well, there and there was a movie called Civil War with Captain America: Civil War. Yeah, see, they do all kind of blur together.
If you tend to look at that one, then you know what is happening between Captain America and Iron Man, the reason why there's a fight between those two.
Or tension between with Thor and so forth.
Yep. But the only thing you really know is, you have to know is who Thanos is and what Thanos did and why they are intent on
fighting
him again.
But I think it does help if you've spent time with these characters, because the weight of what happens to them is greater, I think, if you watch them develop over the
time. I guess my only problem here was, I do think that we do have some formidable female characters throughout this series. There were a couple of people I wish they had focused on a little bit more in this particular iteration of the story. A.O. Scott said something in his review to the effect that this whole story is ultimately about friendship. You know, I'm struggling a little bit with that, because I think it is about loyalty, and I think it is about the Avengers coming together in a sense where they haven't always been on the same page, so to speak. And I don't know, I'm struggling to...
And sacrifice, too.
Yeah, so that's what I was just curious if you agreed with that underlying friendship notion.
I think so, and I think that that's what drives a lot of these comic series anyway, especially the big crossover issues that we get so often, especially with the Avengers movies, because there is a big moment at the end of Endgame, or near the end of Endgame, where it's basically a roll call of all the characters that, that we know, and they show up one at a time, and we go, oh, there's so-and-so, there's, I don't want to give away who specifically, but I mean, it is pretty much everybody. And it's like basically the series finale kind of feeling. It's like the last episode of a show that's been going on for a really long time, or the last season of a show that's been going on for a long time, and they bring back all the characters that have been recurring presences throughout the series, and now they're all back together again, and we can give them a send-off. Of course, I also think that there is the built-in complication here, which is that because we know there are going to be more movies with these characters, that sense of finality isn't as,
you know. I mean, it's not the end game?
It's like when they did Friday the 13th, the final chapter. It was like, that was
false
advertising.
Well, it'll take a while to come back, but
I think it was a year later.
Yeah, and then it was a new beginning.
Well, and I think part of the issue is here, so if we're talking about the Avengers as a group, as this group of friends, pseudo-family, however you want to characterize it, versus the individual characters. I mean, I assume the individual storylines are going to continue.
Yeah, and we know that because Marvel has announced their timeline.
Right, I really hope that this is the end game for this sort of Avengers notion and whatever. Because if it's not, then I, $1.2 billion aside, I will not be happy.
Because, I mean, if this is the period at the end of the sentence, it's a pretty good one.
Yeah
I think so.
I agree. And that was Avengers Endgame. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Under the Silver Lake and Diane. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Murray Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed Avengers Endgame. Let's now move to a couple of films on the other end of the, if nothing else, box office spectrum. The video on demand offerings Under the Silver Lake and Diane. Let's begin with a bit of LA weirdness. We know director David Robert Mitchell from a couple of previous feature films, 2010's coming-of-age study The Myth of the American Sleepover and 2014's eminently creepy horror flick It Follows. Under the Silver Lake is something different, a blend of mystery and commentary that centers on a character played by one-time Spider-Man actor Andrew Garfield, who thinks he sees a conspiracy behind every song, comic book, and cereal box that falls either virtually or literally into his lap. Question is, can he find the solution to the quote-unquote mystery before he gets evicted from his apartment near the L.A. Reservoir?
So this is a movie that premiered at the Cannes Film Festival a couple years ago. It was hotly anticipated because David Robert Mitchell, as you said, made It Follows, which was kind of a breakout indie horror success and a movie that I like a lot. And it kind of received divisive reactions. And it's a movie that seems almost designed to be divisive and then has been getting shuffled around. They keep moving the release dates. It seems like this thing's never going to come out. A24 was the studio that picked it up. And
which
now it's
bizarre because A24 usually hits winners
time. Yeah, totally. And so they seemed almost like they were hedging their bets with this one. And now it's finally being dumped on VOD. And I think it's a little better than that reputation suggests, but I still had issues with this movie, Under the Silver Lake. Andrew Garfield plays this hangdog loser who lives rent-free in this LA apartment, although his landlord is constantly knocking on the door trying to get him to pay the check, and he keeps moving the deadline, like, all right, I'll give you 3 more days. Okay, I'll give you another 3 days. And he mostly spends his time, because he doesn't work, spying on his neighbors, Rear Window style, and that's how he meets the woman across the way, who's played by Riley Keough, channeling Marilyn Monroe a little bit here. And they start a relationship, and almost immediately thereafter, she goes missing. Her apartment is just cleared out in the middle of the night. There's a weird symbol on the wall. And Sam, the Andrew Garfield character, becomes convinced that this disappearance is somehow related to the murder of this billionaire investor that's all over the news. And that leads him through this scavenger hunt of hidden messages where he's finding patterns in song lyrics. He's seeing things in old movies that line up with what's happening in the real world. As you said, there's a plot device involving a cereal box at some point, this map that's inside a cereal box. He's even going through old Nintendo Power magazines and finding things in them. And you're not really sure throughout this film if you're supposed to take any of this seriously, because we're watching him figure these things out and it seems like there's some credence to it, or if you're supposed to think that he's just completely out of his mind and finding patterns where none actually exist. So there's a lot going on in this movie, Under the Silver Lake, and it's something of a refracted image of itself, because Mitchell's first film, The Myth of the American Sleepover, is referenced in this too. So I'm not totally sure what he was doing with that. But there's a lot of Pynchon in this. I was reminded of Inherent Vice, the Paul Thomas Anderson adaptation of that Pynchon novel. There's a lot of Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye in this. There's all kinds of stuff. I mean, you're constantly calling out references. And so in that way, it's something akin to the main character of the film, where you're constantly finding these little clues in the background or sometimes in the foreground of this movie.
Makes a good drinking game.
Yeah. Oh, you would be toasted by a half an hour into this. And it's a long film. It's 2.5 hours long. And I don't know, a little of this went a long way for me. I mean, it's beautifully shot by Michael Giolakis, who also did It Follows. Andrew Garfield's really good. He's a total scumbag in this movie, and I always admire a movie that has the courage to be about a total scumbag. And I don't know, it's biting the hand that feeds it in a way, because it seems designed to make people on the internet freeze frame every shot to find all these things that he's hidden in the backgrounds and on people's clothes. And yet at the same time, it's kind of making fun of that mentality. So I don't know, this movie's kind of in on its own joke, but it's kind of insufferable at the same time. I might need to see it again, but I also don't know if I want to at the same time.
Well, that's part of the issue here. So Dan and I did not see this movie because it's streaming on demand, right?
Yeah, so you can rent it on iTunes and Amazon and all those places.
Right, and so we were traveling, it was 2.5 hours long and so forth.
And you already seen Avengers Endgame, so you don't need
another yeah. But I guess, you know, if you're not enthused about it and you're generally a huge fan of the director, I don't know if I'm going to take the time to see it. But maybe, because I like the underlying concept and I like the LA motif and I like the sort of
the mystery of
Yes, we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. It's been getting really all over the place reactions. People seem to either really love this or really hate this. I'm kind of in both camps simultaneously, if that makes sense. So I think it's worth seeing, but whether or not you want to get on its wavelength is another thing entirely.
And that was Under the Silver Lake. Let's close with Diane. For some of us, especially for those whose past includes trauma, painful memories can and often do shape how the rest of our life unfolds. That's the case with Diane, whose given name is the title of a meditative movie written and directed by Kent Jones and which stars Mary Kay Place. Though we never find out exactly what happened to Diane in her distant past, Jones gives us clues that show up in her troubled relationship with her drug-taking son, well played by Jake Lacy, in her momentary conflict with a dying cousin, and in a sequence that involves her drinking alone in a bar until she is barely able to stand, much less walk. Most of all, though, Diane works hard at being a good person, dispensing food to the needy, communing with her friends, even doing the laundry for her ungrateful son, but doing so always as if she were laboring to make amends. Place, a veteran actress probably best known for her role in the 1970s sitcom Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, imbues Diane with a sensitivity that will mean much, if not most, to those who have a distinct feel for the pangs of regret.
And, of course, I always think of Mary Kay Place in The Big Chill.
That's what I was going to say.
Absolutely.
And because this is sort of an ensemble performance as well, with clearly the focal point on her, hence the title, you know, it sort of reminded me of that film at various points. But, oh, this was so difficult to watch, I thought. You know, people talk about being affected by movies. A couple of years ago, there was a film out that starred Adam Driver titled Patterson. And it was about a Gen X guy who is driving a bus and a very slow reveal of daily life in Diane. It's the same sort of approach, except the main character happens to be in her late 60s. And wow, I mean, her life is so devoid of meaning, yet full of opportunities to have greater meaning, that it was, as I said, really challenging to watch. But there were great performances. Mary Kay Place really does deserve an Oscar nomination for this film. But
Jake Lacy was good. Andrew Martin was good. Andrew Martin, we remember from SCTV many, many years ago, and who's been in several movies.
Estelle Parsons, an Oscar award winner.
Glynis O'Connor is in there for like 2 seconds. There are really good performances. I would say the difference between this and Patterson was that ultimately Patterson was lighthearted. Ultimately, it was a positive look. I love the Adam Driver character. This is exactly the opposite. It's
because
struggling.
We know that
she's struggling to do the right thing, even though we know in the past somewhere
she
has done some bad things.
I guess the one thing I would like to say about Diane is I'm still kind of in awe of the fact that this was written and directed by a man.
And a former film critic at that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because he says that well, am I jumping on you, Mary Pat? I
mean, go ahead.
He said, go mansplain this to us.
No.
Yeah. He explained in an interview that he based this on a trio of aunts that he had and just hanging around with them and listening to them talk and about their lives and everything, their hopes, their dreams, and desires. So he came to this theme from an informed point of view. I mean,
I don't disagree with that, because he could not have gotten this dialogue, these thoughts, these relationships so right if he hadn't had some opportunity to have this ongoing examination of who these people are. But even the way it's filmed, there are several shots of just her car sort of driving on this like northeast road and so forth.
So many full frontal shots of her and unabashedly her in her 60s, just, you know,
right,
just
her
going,
face. And as you said, Jake Lacy, who some people will recognize because he had a recurring role in the sitcom or the HBO series Girls.
He was on The Office, too.
Yes, exactly. And he does a great job here, because he has to sort of switch gears at various points.
Yeah.
And it's different from any other performance we've seen him render to date.
If I didn't sell you guys on Under the Silver Lake, which you didn't see, you guys sold me on Diane, which I haven't seen yet. So I'm definitely going to go home and rent this one.
Well, good. I think most people should. That was Diane, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Murray, Pat Truthart, and I discussed Avengers Endgame and Under the Silver Lake. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevenin for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll continue our quest to find good film wherever it lurks. Until then, remember this quote from the late Stan Lee. Bigotry and racism are among the deadliest social ills plaguing the world today, but unlike a team of costumed supervillains, they can't be halted with a punch to the snoot or a zap from a ray gun. The only way to destroy them is to expose them, to reveal them for the insidious evils they really are. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.